Welcome to another episode from Education Sense, the podcast by teacher for teachers, with me, Isabel Rich, and my co-host, David Marshall. We may be recording this on a very hot evening in Bath today, but it is not going to deter us from having a cracking pod. Oh, David, is it hot in London today?
It is hot in London today, but surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, I'm wearing a little jumper here because I feel the, I get a little cool. So I actually have a jumper on, even though it's kind of 30 degrees here. So this is very strange. Apologies.
Yeah, actually, I have just seen that. I'm in a little vest top, David. There you are in your black jumper, looking slightly autumnal. Maybe you've got a bit of reptile in you or something. Anyway.
Very likely. Cold-blooded.
Yes, I know, but warm-hearted. Anyway, enough about our weather chat and David's strange jumper wearing in 30 degrees C. It's time to get back to what we're going to be chatting about today. So today we are going to be delving into the neuroscience behind how children learn and use that to think about what a dream school might look like and actually even smell like. That's going to make a lot more sense once you've listened to the whole podcast. We're really lucky to have a guest with us who's going to help us discover the way children learn and develop and really kind of use that information to shape and form what this dream school might look like. Her name's Dr. Rebecca Torrance-Jenkins. Rebecca specialises in translating insights from neuroscience and psychology into practical, transformative tools and tips for children, charity, schools and learning environments. She is all about creating spaces where the human brain can truly thrive, which I'm sure you can all agree is just what we strive for as teachers. That's our real goal in life. How can we make children thrive? She argues that we should and we can design education around how children's brains actually learn rather than around timetables, buildings or preset curricula. Her not-for-profit programme in the northwest of England won a She Inspires Award, and she founded a prep science department in a school named STEM Prep School of the Year 3 years later. As a writer and researcher, she bridges academic insight and real-world impact, which I'm sure you'll all agree is just what we try to do on this podcast and hopefully try to help you with how you can put theoretical practice into the classroom. She has included a chapter in a new book that's coming out from Cambridge University Press on neuro-informed policy for SEND. She's also a council member of the educational neuroscience think tank Learnus, and she's a learning consultant for an ed tech platform helping shape the future of education. So she's a busy lady, and she's a lady that we really wanted to talk to because I'm sure you agree that getting an understanding of how a child learns and what we can do to make their classroom experience as good as possible is so important. Welcome, Rebecca, and thank you for joining us. And I hope you're not overheating too much when you're down the road from me in Bath.
Okay, thank you so much for having me. It's lovely to be here. Not too hot, no, because my shirt's a bit wet from having sponged off my children's pesto chicken. So I'm keeping nice and cool. Thank you.
Good. David, when we were doing some research for this podcast, you suddenly turned to me and went, Plato's Republic. And I was a bit like, what? What's the connection here? So, David, before we go any further and really delve into what Rebecca's got to say, can you talk to me a little bit more about that theory, please?
Yeah, well, it was Rebecca, Your suggestion for this podcast was designing a dream school. And I just loved that idea because I think all teachers, all parents and anyone who's got anything to do with education, just we just want the school to be the best it can be for the children. And that's just the driving force for everyone in education. And so, you know, you sat around the staff room or you sat around at dinner and you're chatting, what would the dream school look like? And Isabel, when you said this, I thought, yeah, Republic, because there's this, the massive Republic is this bit where Socrates has this dialogue with all these people. And effectively, it starts off talking about justice, but effectively it's what would a good state look like? It starts off with justice because that's the opening. And then it ends up with them kind of adding bits and more bits until you end up with not just one state, but a sort of series of interconnected city states. That is the ideal. I don't know where I'm going with this, except for the fact that I love the idea, and it just made me think there's a history of people creating ideals and dreams and utopias going back thousands of years. But what if it could come true as well? And that's probably the most exciting thing. Rebecca, I don't know if you want to take it on from me, because I'm rambling now.
Thanks for that lead. That's a really juicy one.
You are Socrates here in this
Yeah, I am.
situation.
Well,
Socrates.
you are indeed our Socrates. And I guess you've got so much experience behind you, Rebecca. You've done a lot of research and you've actually got in-class practical experience. And what's I guess what I'd love to know is what brought you to this place? What brought you to have this fascination with neuroscience, and trying to make it have practical implications in the classroom?
Well, that's a good question. I came to this field through both experience and curiosity. So I've always been fascinated by how people learn, and also sometimes a little frustrated by seeing schools that are working against a kind of human natural process. But I began, so my career began at the Dragon School in Oxford, which is an unselective but completely remarkable school that really valued the whole child. And they celebrated quirkiness. It didn't seem, feel like it was being driven by grades. But to fit in, you had to have something different, something special, something remarkable. And I was so inspired by many of the teachers there. I thought they were excellent. I spent lots of my free time or non-contact time watching the other teachers. And I was trying to work out, what is it these amazing teachers do? Is it instinct? Is it something that you can study, write down, and then share? Or is it just a bit of magic they have that the children adore? I then moved to Dulwich Prep, London, and I also watched some incredible teachers there. Mr. Tovenhouse's history lessons were so exciting that I genuinely used to spend any non-contact time hovering the doorway of his room. And I remember watching him actually making children shed tears during a mime of what it would be like to be hanged, drawn, and quartered. And they just memorized everything he said without even thinking. So that curiosity led me off to do a master's and then a PhD looking at educational neuroscience and specifically what is it that those magical, inspiring teachers do? How is it? What route does it take through a learning brain? And can you kind of codify it? And if so, let's have a go at doing that. So how can we design teaching that aligns with how the brain actually learns? So since then, I've worked with 25 schools, with charities, like you say, and I've worked in the state sector, the independent sector, primary schools, secondary schools, through schools. And there's a common theme in all these schools, you get some incredible teachers, and I would just really love to know exactly what it is they're doing and how we can pin it down on paper. Can I go back to your question, David, about Plato? Because I just you
Please
got me
do.
thinking. Yeah. So if we're going to go right back to the very beginning, the original, the true, the root meaning of educate is to draw out. So in chemistry less physics lessons, we used to say duct to draw, educate. It's in there in education. So actually, he was a pretty modern in his thoughts. He was arguing that we should design learning around human development. So rather than forcing children through a rigid system, actually, let's have a look at how active learning should be. It's through active engagement, it's emotion, it's personal meaning, and sitting and deeply knowing a child. And those themes are coming back now. So I think there's a big resurgence in those kind of old, know the child, draw out what they're capable of, interact with them. There's a lovely piece of research that came out this year about brain synchronicity. And when a child learns with a human, interacting, instantly, not through a worksheet, but face to face, then their brains become synchronized and the learning is deeper, it's more meaningful.
And I think Socrates, he was killed, or he had to take hemlock because he was accused of corrupting the youth, wasn't he? So his educational methods, they weren't popular with the kind of powers of Athens that were there. So hopefully this doesn't happen to you as well. I mean, this is if we're running along the kind of Socratic line of comparing to Socrates, we're hoping that does not happen. But it sounds like you've been doing You've been creating ways in which we understand how learning can be successful. And I think we're going to hear a bit about some of the learning environment key facts that you've been working on and the science of learning really sort of infused through all of this. It's been really exciting actually, because you sent this to us, and just today I've been kind of reading through it and going, oh, wow, this connects up to all these other things we've been thinking about as well. But just going back to where we started the conversation is about the problems to do with education. Because I think any conversation about a dream school or dream education starts off with teachers or educators or parents grumbling about the current system. So I thought a really good place to begin would be for us to have a moan and a rant about some of the things that we think in education don't work and don't serve our children to the best that they could be served.
Yeah, well, I think it's very important not to in any way blame teachers or be negative about teachers and the current state of things, because we've sort of inherited this system. So there are mostly absolutely fantastic and brilliant teachers doing a wonderful job, but I just think the system is geared up against them. And when I see teachers of classes of 30 and they're trying to teach some year 10s, some physics, you just look and you think, God, that it is incredible that the teachers are doing as much as they are. So this is absolutely no way a criticism of what's going on in the classroom. It's more the system itself. And I think you then have to sort of go back, perhaps not back to Plato, but the trouble with the system is it's built on the old idea that some people are naturally clever and some just aren't. But now we know that that's simply not true. Intelligence comes in many forms, but we sort of still clung to this way of schooling that's designed to sort children rather than support them. So, I mean, we can use different models. Howard Gardner's six intelligences is a really useful way of looking at what is true intelligence, and it's kind of shaken up how we view IQ. But we still divide learning into separate subjects, even though when children leave school and they have a career, that the kind of the real world is anything but siloed. They're having to move between different realms and interact in different ways. We still ask children to memorize facts, even though they can access anything with a tap on their phone. I don't have to memorize that many facts in my job, and we wouldn't really expect other people to. And we still rely on pen and paper exams, which are sat by children all at the exact same time in their life, give or take 11 months, rather than assessing when a child is actually ready. So, like in a driving test, nobody says to you, when did you pass your driving test? How many attempts did it take? You either pass or you haven't. So, yeah, I think that's another problem. And traditionally, we group children by age. We're not designed to learn in the same age group settings. And in fact, schools that are now introducing mixed age settings have seen bullying just drop off and the kind of social hierarchy jostling tails away, because there's a natural hierarchy that sits with how humans are designed to live. And we group them in sort of rigid hour-long lessons or worse, like 40-minute slot. Again, no human has ever learned that way naturally, but it's the only way to shoehorn in or get through the timetable, batch process people through a system. But the most shocking thing I think is that when I did my teacher training 20 years ago, we were never taught at any point how brains actually learn. And in fact, I went back to Homerton where I did my teacher training, and I looked at the syllabuses and talked to some of the lecturers. At no point on their curriculum is the word brain even used. So, for an educational neuroscientist, I find that really sad. You wouldn't ask a mechanic to fix a car without knowing how an engine worked. And I feel it's a little bit, I know that's rather a blunt analogy, but it's similar in teaching. How can you teach a child's brain if you don't really know how a brain works? And I know in neuroscience, we actually don't know as much as perhaps the press would lead you to think we do, but we know enough to make a difference. And I think really now it's time to kind of stop tweaking the old system, and perhaps it's a chance, an opportunity to start creating something that actually fits the world that our children are growing into and fits how their brains learn.
Yeah, I think
I agree with everything you say, Rebecca. It's totally fascinating to listen to, and I'm shocked by that statistic about teacher training not really including that much about neuroscience. neuroscience. And it's going to be one of those answers that comes down to practicalities, isn't it, and budgets. But what I admire as well is it's not only you that's beating the drum for change. I watched the Jamie Oliver Dyslexia Revolution program this week, and that was really poignant because he too believes that the system does not suit. Particularly, he's focusing on dyslexics, but he said those with learning needs, which make up about 25% of most classes, the system does not work for them. And it was really emotional watching his reaction to his experience at school and the experience of other people with learning needs. And it wasn't a positive one. And that feels really sad that that's still the case in 2025. And so I feel this is a very timely conversation as well, because if Jamie Oliver's doing it, well, hell, revolution might well be on its way.
And just added to that as well, in the 25%, in every school I've been to in the last year, I've asked roughly what proportion of your children have a kind of registered special educational need, and it's a consistent 25% everywhere. But then all the teachers caveat that with, but there are a whole load more who we know have to be taught in a special way that aren't on our list. And the other thing that everybody agrees with, neuroscientists, teachers, everybody, if we taught everybody in a way that suited a neurodiverse child, everybody would benefit. There is literally no harm that will come to anybody by making it dyslexia friendly, being a bit more aware of children with ADHD or ASD. The whole Everybody would thrive. So I think there is a wave coming, a sea change coming. I sense it in schools that we are moving more towards that.
Because some of these things, like dual coding, right? They're really great for every child because we take in information through the ears and through the eyes. So if we combine our, teacher instruction with some visuals, everyone's going to benefit, not just the
Exactly.
children who we might be sort of specifically designing the lesson for. That makes total sense. And yeah, I think you're right. I think there is a, you talked earlier about how many brilliant teachers you've seen and watched and listened to. That is definitely the case, and I think one really strong aspect of teaching in the UK, where we're all based, is the great research that's made available to teachers. The CPD that you get, Research Aid, Wellington College Festival Education, and all of those tons of things that are kind of out there doing amazing things. So yeah, it feels, I agree, it feels like there is a change coming or in the process of happening, but it really can't come too soon, particularly for those children, Isabel, like you say, who are really not finding that our education system suits them. I also just wanted to add in a few things because I had a quick look on Reddit. I don't know if you're familiar with Reddit, but it's kind of got a bad reputation. But I found that if you are looking for something specific, which may be to do with making iced tea, for example, or in this case, what's the problem with education systems? It can be, it's a community forum. So I had a quick look to add to our discussion. What do people on Reddit think is wrong with education? I think quite a few people are coming from the US, but it's probably relevant here as well. So this was a Reddit thread from 2 years ago, and the first one that came up was it referred to warehousing kids in the US. They said they were, which isn't a term that I've come across before, but I think we can probably all guess what it means. It kind of has that feeling of an industrial education system with children being churned through, exactly as you say, Rebecca, your frustrations about kind of everything timetabled. At the same time, children learning on a supposedly sort of age rate sort of basis, and a system which is kind of scaled up to the max.
I'm thinking Amazon. All I can think of is warehouse and
Yes.
Amazons. I'm thinking highly efficient logistics, very large space, lots of stuff all being processed.
The other ones that came up, just got a few more, I'll run through them. One person was concerned about not celebrating students' academics. Interestingly, it mentioned that sports were celebrated, but not academics. Again, maybe a little bit US focused. The not surprising to see that social media and phones is on that list. Lack of engagement in school. A couple of people citing parents not engaging with school as being a problem. And there was someone called the sociology cat, feels that so much responsibility is falling on schools, there should be socialization and life lessons and all that good stuff in addition to an education. So maybe feels that schools are taking the brunt of a lot of kind of social issues. And this one was my favorite. One user called Maybe I'm the Nanny claims to have direct evidence that standardized testing is the issue, but they didn't post a link to that evidence, which I would love to see. But standardized testing, celebrating success, social media and phones, lack of engagement, and responsibility of everything on schools. Do these seem like they're ringing bells with us?
I think so.
Yeah, for sure.
Isabel, over to you.
Yeah, I feel, golly, I'm feeling a little depressed right now. I feel like we need to lift ourselves up for a moment.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
It's the Reddit
I
thread effect.
it's the Reddit thread effect. It's probably like reading Mum's Net on somebody whinging about. I don't know quite what they'd be whinging about. I don't personally read it. But anyway, yeah, I feel there is a lot wrong with the system that we have. It does feel Victorian. In Jamie Oliver's TV show, they had people going Dickensian rather loudly with their placard, and I was like, yes, I sort of agree with you. However, I mean, for quite a lot of children, we must remember that the system does work. It's not a system that doesn't work. There's loads of kids that do thrive their way through school, but there is a large chunk of people, this 25%, who it really isn't working for. And there would be, as you say, Rebecca, everyone will benefit from making some tweaks, making some changes to what the system is. But now it's time to kind of move away from the issues and talk about things really positively and talk about this dream school, but not just sort of say, this is what we should all be doing. What we want to hear from you, Rebecca, is why we should be doing these things. And your information that you use with schools and charities, etc., is so clear. And I love its structure of giving an idea of what people can do, but also the reason behind that. And as I was sort of reading through your different ideas of what we can do in schools, I found it really handy. You talked about the learning brain. And from when I was looking through the list, it seems there's some overarching sort of categories that you think about when you're coming about seeing change. And for me, tell me if I'm right about this. It seemed to divide into broadly the sort of emotional status of a child, getting that right. Then you've got a section that's about the physical environment of the school, which I find totally fascinating and quite innovative. And then we've got this section that's really thinking with your neuroscience hat on how the brain cognitively learns. Are those the sort of main areas you say, the sort of emotional status, physical classroom environment, how the brain learns
And then
that?
pedagogy as well, a bit about
Okay.
the art of teaching itself, imparting knowledge, that bit too.
Fantastic. So maybe first up, I think you make a really good point about the fact that not much learning can go on if a child is not feeling emotionally secure. So maybe you could tell us, first of all, a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, how a child feels emotionally has a huge impact on how well they can learn. So, from a brain perspective, emotions and learning aren't separate at all. They're completely intertwined. And if a child is stressed or anxious or feeling unsafe, then the brain prioritizes survival over learning. So, one of the key things that I've learned in all of this journey is that the brain's priorities put learning as number four. So, brains were designed for movement. Things that don't move don't have brains. Trees don't have brains. Jellyfish don't have brains, or rather they're a type of plankton. They don't move when they want. So the brain will always prioritize a movement over everything else, and that can be tiny movements like focusing an eye to stare at a whiteboard, or using a fidget toy because you just have to move. You need to move. So there's movement first, and then we've got socializing and emotion. So if a child is sat there and they've had a really terrible start to the day, they've had an argument with their parents, they've fallen out with their friend, their brain is programmed to put that thought above any new learning. And they can't, they're worried about, you haven't done the homework. We've all remember that. You sit there and you think, oh my God, they're going to ask me now where my homework sheet is. And you don't bank anything in that lesson because a brain will prioritize emotions and socializing, the other priority. If we hadn't prioritized socializing, we wouldn't be here today. So I'll try and kind of condense that thought into a sentence. But when humans started to walk upright, their pelvises narrowed. With a narrow pelvis meant that women had to give birth to their babies much younger, far younger. For a mother to keep her newborn baby alive, she could no longer do it on her own. You had to have a tribe, a community. So those that cooperated and worked as a social group survived. Those that didn't survive. So we've got this sort of module built in, drive to socialize and to understand other people's emotions built into our brains. Learning new things, particularly non-essential things. So in neuroscience, a non-essential learning event would be anything that doesn't keep you alive. So I'm afraid no matter how jazzy your photosynthesis lesson is, it's not a survival, it isn't necessary for survival, so it won't be prioritized. Once those three things are kind of in stasis or satisfied, then a child can learn. So if a child walks up at the door and they're looking distressed or sulky or moody or something's gone wrong, of course, there isn't time. You have a class of 30. A teacher can't sit down and sort it out with that child. But if you just say to the child, I can see you're really upset. I'm really sorry. Could we have a chat after the lesson? Or is there somebody that you could speak to? Or, what could we do about it? Acknowledge, and then you move on to the lesson. That child will then be engaged because they felt sort of emotionally safe and listened to. So I hope that makes sense. So yeah, if the child feels calm and supported and connected, then the brain is much more open to taking in new information and making lasting memories.
And I like the idea. You've given a really good practical tip there because you're totally right. You're acknowledging that you can't just leave the rest of your 29 students to fend for themselves while you sort out child one. But your idea of quickly acknowledging them, or so many schools now have people they can go and talk to during a lesson if they need to. But recognizing and realizing that forcing them to come and sit in that lesson and just sort of get on as best they can is just not the right method. That's really good.
And I noticed that when you are speaking to children at the beginning of the lesson, just little things can make such a difference.
Huge, yeah.
It just shift from saying, oh, you haven't got your pencil case or you're late, to the kind of positive, oh, well done for bringing your pencil case, or it's great that you've kind of it's great that you've thought to sort of do this or that. And the latter negative things, if they're not done, you can leave them to later on in the lesson. You can pick them up. You don't need to ask children about their homework first thing.
We have a real, genuine pandemic of anxiety at the moment, and I think there are so many ways we could reduce that. When a child's anxious, they can't learn. Why are so many schools still punishing children, actually punishing them for being disorganized when you have, well, let's say a quarter of the population have an organizational issue. If you have dyslexia or ADHD, you're probably going to struggle to remember all your belongings. I was so scatty at school, and luckily my school was very small and very sweet, and we didn't get told off too much. But I've taught children in their primary phase, and then seen, and they've had a joyous time and been loved and supported, and then they go up to the senior phase, and you meet them being driven around the school block three times by their parent because they can't get out of the car. And then when you sort of say, well, let's have a chat about it. Oh, I forgot my pencil case. Why do we, I still don't understand why we have this strange system that seems to kick in the secondary sector. Why can't we say, guys, if you ever need a pencil, there's a pot on my desk, just help yourself. And then you've just got rid of the anxiety and the children are fine again. The other one that I don't understand, I still can't get to the bottom of it. And it happens in many of the schools I work with. They have these strange rules about wearing blazers, wearing school uniform. You have to have your blazer on in between lessons. So I've walked out of lessons where I've been observing, say, a geography lesson, chatting away to a child, and you walk around the corner, bam, detention, because they've got their blazer over their arm. And I've actually gone to some senior management officers and said, can you just talk me through what the point of this is? Because you've just turned that child off now. They're probably going to go one of two ways. They're going to get really anxious, or they're going to protect themselves, disengage, and not bother anymore, and not care if they get detentions, et cetera. So I'd love to know, I'd love someone to explain the ethos behind that, because it doesn't happen in primary schools. It's mainly joy, the overriding emotion, and in primary schools is joy and innovation and love and care. And then bam, one of the parents at a school that I visited said, it's such a shame that children are criminalized by the school system at age 11. Why? Why are they treated like criminals? And I kind of see her point. Her child was being punished repeatedly for disorganization. That's not to do with learning. I don't know. Maybe I'm a lone voice out there, but I just don't understand that.
No, I don't think you are. I guess in their defense, they're trying to have, I suppose, certain standards and expectations. And their argument would be encouraging independence and responsibility, I guess. But for me, I go back to the same point. It's about perhaps recognizing that that doesn't work for all students, and therefore you need to alter your expectations, or they have to have a special dispensation that's attached to them as
Well,
a
I think of
person.
like the real world. Imagine if you had a boss that said every time you left your office you had to put a scratchy jacket on. I mean, no one would work for that boss. I think there's ways around it.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you on the blazer front. I mean, I was just thinking and reflecting on myself teaching these days, which I do on a one-to-one basis. And I no longer panic when I've got a slightly gloomy looking child that arrives because they're a little bit tired or they don't really want to be with me. And I've decided it's way better to, I'm not even going to use the verb waste, to use the first minute and a half or 2 minutes of my hour to chat about what they've been up to and whether they're eating, have just had Cocoa Pops for breakfast, or whether they watched the football last night. And it's totally and utterly unrelated to anything that we're going to be learning. But every time I do it, that gloomy little person that arrived on screen to have their lesson, once we've had a chat about something that they enjoy or what they've eaten, they immediately relax and I can see them engaging. And so I just think you're so right. It's really important to remember that the emotional connection you have with your pupils and their state of mind is going to matter hugely to how they're going to perform in the lesson. David, you've got your little hand waving. What do you want to say?
I have hands up. I've got my
Yeah, go
hand
on
up. No
then.
one can see it, but you can
David,
see
you
me.
can talk.
I can talk now. Well, I think, this comes back to the teacher, and I so strongly believe this. It's pretty much proven with lots of research, but you don't need research to prove it. It's the teacher's relationship with the child that is
Absolutely.
the crucial thing. And I know in secondary school we have lots of teachers, and the prep system which I teach in, we actually do have quite a lot of teachers, even though it's, primary. But it's that teacher having the emotional awareness of what's going on with them, so that they can then adjust the mood or the lesson, shift the learning, or switch it, or shift themselves, and that kind of ability to be flexible. I noticed, Rebecca, in your slide of key strategies, you had meditation, and I've been meditating pretty much all my adult life, and it's absolutely certain to me that I wouldn't be able to do the job I do if I didn't meditate, if I didn't have space for stillness in my life. Because if I come to a lesson agitated as a teacher, then I'm not going to be able to listen to the emotional state and regulate myself in order to help regulate the children. So, Isabel, your example of, asking the children how their day is, it's sometimes you come in and you just know that's the right thing to do, don't you? And sometimes the alternative is actually it's better. These children just need like a piece of work to get stuck into because they're really kind of hungry and ready to go. They don't want chit chat, they just want to go. So you're picking up what's going on and then you respond to it. And
And
you have your plan, but
it's knowing and being known. I think that is so important. If you go to
definitely.
where you're learning, if you feel you're deeply known and you feel that you know everybody in the room, you're comfortable. If you go somewhere where you don't know, I mean, as an adult, you go into a meeting, you don't know anybody, you haven't been introduced to them. It's really difficult to know and be known. I think it's really interesting when I do my workshops, I ask, can you please think of your favorite lesson at school? Your favorite subject, sorry. It's not, and then I say, okay, was it the subject or was it the teacher? And it's north of 90% say, okay, yeah, fair, it was the teacher. The teacher was brilliant. She told us great stories. She was so interesting. She really cared about us. He was so funny. It's the teacher, it's the relationships, definitely.
No, I was just going to talk a little bit more now and move on to talk about, we've discussed this emotional connection with our pupils. So we can now imagine we're in a situation where we have got an emotionally engaged group of pupils. We've covered up any problems. We've engaged with them on a personal level. What I wanted to talk about next, and I found this fascinating because it's something I've noticed from going around schools, is the impact of the physical environment of the classroom and the school on children. And I'd love you to talk a little bit about that because you've got various different aspects of that cover and really good reasons behind it.
It was really quite surprising. We came up with sort of 20 things that teachers could do with the research, and everything had to pass the test of what can I do in my classroom on Monday? If you couldn't answer that question, it wasn't really that useful. So we had lots of different ideas, lots of different tips, but people, schools, teachers tended to go for the environment one first. We have them in no particular order. It seems, to use an awful phrase, like the low-hanging fruit. If you get your environment right and it feels like a nice place to learn, everything else follows. And when I go to schools to do a workshop, there's always about a third of the audience have very pointy elbows. They've been at the school for 40, 50 years. They know what they're doing. They can get their children an A at Common Entrance or whatever. They don't need me to come in and tell them what to do. So the environment is a really good way in because I can then say, yeah, you could try changing this. We could try doing that. And these are the reasons why it might work. And this is what you'd see if it was working. It's easy to do. The teachers work in teams. They change it up, and very quickly the pointy elbows come back at the next workshop and they'll say, oh, it's a really amazing difference it's made to the room. And then they're much more open to trying some of the other things. So the first thing I focus on is clutter. If you imagine clutter as noise, when a child walks into a very cluttered room with washing lines and brightly coloured backed boards and triple, quadruple backed stuff, things flapping in the breeze, it's like they're being shouted at visually all the time. I went to a parents' evening in a classroom where they had teddy bears pinned to the walls and washing lines over the board, and I honestly didn't remember anything that the teacher said because I couldn't stop looking at all the animals and wondering why there was a kangaroo and a bear and so on. And it's the same for a child. If you have a child with ADHD as well, it's almost torturous sticking them in a room like that. The colours as well. If you think that humans haven't really changed, our brains haven't really changed since the Stone Age. So I take that as my premise, my starting point. A Stone Age brain is not designed to sit in a very stimulating, very noisy room. Let's pair it right back and use natural colours. So any shade of wood, terracotta, greens, pale blues. The primary school children tend to work better with warmer colours like peaches and terracottas. At secondary school, it tends to be more sort of blues and greens. But keep it really, really calm. And if you have this compulsion to display your children's work, fine. In other schools, we've shifted those displays into the corridors. And then some schools have invested in glass cabinets that you can look at from all four sides, and they stick all the children's work in there and they change it, every month or so that the rooms feel really cool and calm. If you then put some fairy light somewhere or a desk lamp, and you put some pot plants on all the tables, and you stick an armchair or a bean bag or some cushions in the corner, even if the child doesn't use them, that sense of coziness, I'm safe, this is a nice, pleasant place to be, has an impact on their behaviour. And when we start changing classrooms up, usually there's two or three teachers that are keen to go first. And then you walk around the building and you ask the children later, which classrooms do you like best? How do you feel when you're in this room, and how do you feel in that room? And it very quickly the whole school will declutter. Also, it frees the teachers up from that horrible display maintenance thing. When I started teaching, we had to double triple back every board in vivid colours, and the thinking was if the child's in a daydream and they're staring at one of the boards, at least they're learning something.
Oh my God, Rebecca, the displays. I so remember working with David that we would be there late at night on a sort of Tuesday evening going, why are we doing this? And we liked it because we wanted the children to feel proud that they had their beautiful work on the board. But it took an awful lot of time, and there was a lot of double backing and triple backing and laminating and
If you
making
could
sure
fit
everything
that
was.
time into planning a really exciting project, how much more fun would it
Just
be?
getting staples out is a real job. Actually, slight sidetrack, but one of the best things I've ever been taught in terms of backing up is put the staple in at an angle so you can get it out more
Yes.
easily. That being said, I fully agree that we don't want too much on the walls. Sometimes I think you want to, you do need to, yeah, like you said, you've got to celebrate children's work, but if you can get that in the corridors,
Right, and when
even
they're queuing
better.
up outside the lesson and they can see each other's work, it's brilliant. But you obviously there's a working wall. You might need a working wall, so work that's going on right now. Some of the schools we tried giving them whiteboard paint, and they would paint the whole wall in whiteboard paint. Great. At my last school, I learned the best tip of a brilliant teacher who would write on the actual big long tables in whiteboard pens. So that's marvellous. So it has another bonus effect because the children are free to do whatever they like. They know you're not going to pick the table up, carry it down to the headmaster's office and say, look what this child has written. They loved the fact that it was so temporary and they could just wipe it out. But then, going back to the environments, the classrooms, once you'd started the ball rolling, you could then really, really go for it. And we had CO2 monitors in the rooms. Once you get to above 1,000 parts per million of CO2, then cognitive functioning starts to tail off. If you get to 2,000 parts per million, then you can measure it in a test very easy. It's very obvious that people can't think properly. At 3,000 parts per million, I think people are lying down on the floor. So if you don't want the teacher to have more work, but if you say to a child, you're the CO2 monitor, when the alarm goes off, it's your job to stand up and open the windows and open the door and then sit back down again. And the children themselves get really tuned into the air quality. And we ended up doing a science experiment on it, which year groups, after what period of time, which day was lunchtime worse than in the morning, when does our cognitive functioning drop off, and is there a positive correlation with the amount of carbon dioxide in the air? It's really interesting. And when you're in the room as a teacher, you don't notice it. You don't notice it's all foggy. And then somebody else walks in and goes, God, it's really, you need to open a window in here. And then Isabel, you mentioned scent as well. There's oh the scent one is fascinating, and it was probably the one I kind of threw in as number 20, thinking nobody's going to run with the scent one. But it was about, I think it was our third most popular tip that teachers have tried. You've got rosemary for a start, which has a compound in it, 1-8-cineol, which is one of the building blocks of the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. And we use acetylcholine when we're banking memory. It's using the memory system. So, but well, long back through history, people have used rosemary and linked it to remembrance. In one of Shakespeare's plays, somebody says, "Oh, 'tis rosemary for remembrance," and it's customary to wear a sprig of rosemary to a funeral or to give a rosemary plant if somebody's died. And so that this there's some new researchers at Newcastle University put people in booths with different scents, and the rosemary booth always outperformed the others, and they took blood samples before and after. So some schools have really run with that, and they've planted up rosemary hedges outside the classrooms. Some have rosemary pot plants on the desks. Others put rosemary oil on cotton wool, stick it on the radiator. Some schools have invested in air scent diffusers, so they put rosemary on the whole building, start smelling of rosemary. But there's also another way of using scent, which is you code a specific lesson or subject matter with a scent. So it might be lemon for maths, it might be vanilla for English. And the research shows that if you learn that topic of that unit in maths or all of maths all year with that same scent, when you later sit an assessment and you have the same scent, your recall is better. So if you use the scent during encoding, that's the learning, and recall, the assessment, the grades go up. A teacher last year tried it brilliantly, and she kept, I think it was three different scents for three different subjects, and they used them in the exam. And yeah, she said she thinks there was a difference. I don't know whether there was. It was because of the scents. But then in other schools, the teachers have said they love the scents because it makes them feel really calm. And they say, we walk in, it smells gorgeous. Again, the children run it. They choose the scent. They have the scent monitors. And when they feel calm and relaxed and the air smells beautiful and it's clear, then everybody wins.
Well,
Oh,
it's
it's
definitely going to
fascinating.
smell good, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, it's fascinating, Rebecca. I was listening to that, thinking about lemons and maths and whether that would enhance my ability to do a test. On going around the schools that I visit, a lot of people have gone for the decluttering and what I'm going to call naturalization of the classroom environment. So I've seen so many more schools going for Hessian boards to back them with rather than sort of bright purple. And those that have budget to be using more wooden toys with young children, or even the baskets they're using to keep the children's items in being wood and natural and plants. And it does feel so calm. You walk in and you're absolutely right. You feel like it's just takes you down a level, and it's an easy win to back your boards in a more natural colour and not have too much garish plastic around.
Just to carry on Isabel's point there, some schools then say, oh, we can't change our desks. We've got bright red desks. And we know that red changes, is it, well, the colours affect your mood. They literally change how your brain is perceiving the world. And red can be quite an excitation, an exciting colour that makes people's heart rate and blood pressure go up. Interestingly, even blind children. So I've been to schools where they say, we absolutely can't afford to replace all our desks. But one teacher found this brilliant thing. You can buy desk laminate, wood effect laminate, that you just roll. It's like sticky back plastic. You roll it on the desk, it lasts all year, it's cheap as chips. So, yeah, sorry, David, I interrupted you.
No, I can't actually remember what I was going to say now, but it was more interesting to hear about the wood laminate desks. What I do want to do is ask a little bit about your aspects of memory and curiosity. I think we've talked a bit about memory in terms of the sense, and there's a lot more to say about memory, but curiosity. We've run a podcast relatively recently on curiosity, and I'm super curious to know what you've got to say about it. Would you be able to talk about that for a bit?
Curiosity drives learning. It's like the oldest motivator. I would love to see the end of punishments and rewards, sanctions and rewards in schools. Lots of schools have, and it's brilliant. I went to a primary school the other day, and I said, "How do you reward the children?" And the head teacher looked at me with disdain and said, "Well, we say well done." I said, "So you don't have house points?" God, no, that would be a terrible thing to do. Now, that conversation I just would never have heard 10, 15 years ago. So it's teachers now have definitely done a brilliant job, despite the system, of running with intrinsic motivation and tapping into that natural curiosity that's in every single child. All children want to learn. It is there. There's a module in the brain. They're keen to learn. They're curious. And it's a real achievement if you can get a child at 11, 12, 13 to switch that off. I mean, if you tried to design it, I don't think you could do it as swiftly as some places do. Curiosity, novelty, going back to that ancient human brain, if you are in your environment in the Stone Age and you don't notice novel things, you're far less likely to survive. So novelty makes people very curious. So that's one of the things we suggested teachers they could make their classrooms have a bit more novelty. It doesn't mean changing the decor or wearing a funny outfit or dressing up. It just means switching things around every now and then. It could be the seating plan. It could be having everybody sitting on the floor. It could be everybody lying on the desk. You standing on a desk if your head of health and safety lets you do that. We were allowed to stand on desks, but not on chairs. So sometimes I'd stand on the desk, or I'd get the child to stand at the front, or you go outside. Really simple things that brilliant teachers do all the time. But we now know why, that if you make something novel, then children are far more curious about it. Can I talk about a really interesting piece of research? It's about 5 years old, but it's looking at, well, dopamine is the kind of the celebrity neurotransmitter that everybody in the press writes about as the kind of pleasure neurotransmitter. It was not actually the pleasure transmitter. It's a motivating neurotransmitter, and it drives you to go and do something that has previously had a favorable outcome. It emerged as part of the emotional system, the first mammals. So the very, very first early mammals had this part of their limbic system where they would produce dopamine to drive them to do something. It's why you still keep going back for another chocolate from the chocolate box, even though you've absolutely had enough and you feel a bit sick. It's dopamine saying, no, keep doing the behavior, keep doing the behavior. So it's the motivation of the action, not the reward itself. But there's a really interesting piece of research by Professor Paul Howard Jones. And he works at the intersection of neuroscience and education, and he's looks at how rewards impact learning. And what he found was really fascinating. So basically, the way we structure rewards can either boost or blunt a student's curiosity. So we all know a bit about dopamine, but what's less well known is that uncertain rewards, so that's where you're not quite sure if you're going to get something, can actually trigger a bigger and longer lasting dopamine release than rewards that are guaranteed. So it's a bit like how our brains get hooked by games of chance. It keeps us alert and engaged because we might win. So, for example, he gives three examples. If you give a student a reward straight after they get something right, so a sticker or a well done, that's nice. You get a little dopamine spike, but the dopamine spike is quite small and quite short-lived. And sorry, I should say that when we have raised dopamine levels, then learning is enhanced. So a good teacher is raising up the dopamine wherever they can. If you give the reward at the end of the lesson, or even worse, a week later, where they get a house point stuck on their homework sheet, it barely makes a blip. But if the student might get a reward, like one in four people who finish this task get to pick from the prize box, or if you get this question correct, you can spin the wheel of fortune or you can flip a coin, then suddenly the dopamine's flowing and the dopamine stays up for everybody, even the people watching, for a far longer period of time. So everybody's more focused, more engaged, and far more likely, crucially, to remember what they're learning. So yeah, the takeaway is uncertainty can
Wow.
be powerful.
That's super interesting
How
because
interesting,
we,
yeah.
on our very first episode, recorded as the Rest is Education, our previous name, we did gamification. And one of the things that came up in the research that we did was that children and adults also get a kick from watching their friends lose as much as from winning, which is kind of shocking because when you're sort of playing one of these games with leaderboards and things like that, to realize that actually part of the excitement is seeing your friend kind of like crash out. I guess this is video games, right? This is part of the dopamine effect of video games.
As part of watching a football match, or you know,
Right.
like
Yeah, you're
supporting the
watching
other
someone
team.
else lose as well as you win.
I don't know.
Scary.
But yeah, curiosity drives learning. And so when you see really brilliant teachers doing it all the time, and it's lovely going in and saying to them, this is the kind of the neuroscience scientific explanation of why, but they'll pose a brilliant question. So rather than teaching, for example, space is a vacuum. It's not entirely a vacuum, but that's on the curriculum of primary science. Why not? I saw a teacher saying, what would you dial first if you were released out of the International Space Station? Would it be hypothermia? Would it be because you exploded? Would it be because you wouldn't have enough oxygen? And as soon as you pose that silly, curious question, the children are off and the kind of learning happens accidentally.
Leads us on to inquiry learning, I think, which is something that we've been talking about and which I personally, as a teacher, been trying to bring into my lessons. We talked last episode, Isabel, didn't we, about turning things into a question. And that idea of sort of generating curiosity through questions. Just another aside, I tried an inquiry learning lesson with my class last week, and it was so exciting. I have to say, it was one of the most exciting lessons that I was in, not because it was my lesson, but because of what the children said in response to the question. And what one child said, I got the opportunity the next day to see their parent on the gate. And I said, oh, so and so said this and that. It's a really fantastic observation. And she said, yes, she told me last night. And I'm pretty sure that when I've taught pronouns or comprehension skills, it didn't necessarily go home as a feature of conversation that evening. But
The
that
car
lesson
test.
did.
Oh, that's so gratifying, David. That's really great. Yeah, you're right. We brought up that idea of using questions to frame a lesson last time because we were talking about Daniel Willingham's book, Why Do Kids Not Like School? And another person that came up in conversation was Carol Dweck and growth mindset. And I felt that that linked really nicely, Rebecca, in with your theories about our brains not being this rigid thing inside our heads, that they're more plastic than that. And I thought that would be lovely to remind us all about the theories behind that and also how that impacts how we behave in the classroom, I guess.
Absolutely. And if I say to teachers, if you only do one thing, you only change one thing, or you only take one thing away from a neuroscience workshop, it's that brains are plastic. Plastic comes from the ancient Greek word plastos, to mold, where plasticine comes from. And if you know that every single time you experience something new, your brain changes. Our brains have all changed in the last 5 minutes, just through having these conversations. If you teach that to your children and they know that every single day they're going to turn up at school and their brains will rewire and they will change, it's Well, it's the neuroscience support for growth mindsets, isn't it? Children then stop saying, "Oh, so you're not naturally good at maths or naturally good at English. You mean you can work at it?" And it's kind of what Malcolm Gladwell's book Outliers is getting at, and Angela Duckworth's book Grit is getting at, that the ones that plod and keep on going, keep on changing their brain, ultimately and eventually they are the ones that make it to the top. So yeah, if you only take away one thing, it's that your brain is plastic. And there was a lovely piece of research by two Dutch neuroscientists, and they tested that theory that if they did nothing different, but they told one cohort of children, same school, same teacher, same subject, same lessons, that their brains were plastic, and the other group they just taught a mindfulness lesson to. So sorry, both cohorts got the mindfulness lesson, but one group also got the plastic message. And the children that were taught they had that their brains would change every time they learned something new ended up doing better, a whole grade better. But it wasn't just because they didn't just give up. They were more curious and they were more resilient, and they withstood failure more times before they gave up. So yeah, I think that's the most important message you could take from educational neuroscience.
I think that's really interesting. And something I've been interested in seeing when I go and visit schools is those that have the wherewithal and perhaps the ability to be flexible. And that's what I'm finding really interesting. Some of the schools that I have been around recently have been more flexible with their curriculum than others. I visited one recently where they've actually just gone, hang about, the student cohort that we have, they're just not fitting the mold of this traditional way of selecting GCSEs. Actually, for these guys, of course, they've got to do their English and maths, but beyond that, they should be able to choose whatever they want to from what we offer. We don't want to put them into silos of saying, you've got to choose a language, you've got to do a humanities, you've got to do this. And they're lucky, they have flexibility, they've got the resources to use some, probably some amazing AI generated timetabling device and resource device to be able to create a list of GCSEs that really suit individual students. Yes, they're still doing GCSEs, and we could perhaps argue whether that's relevant or not, but at least they're moving in the right direction. This idea that students no longer have to stick to rigid buckets of GCSEs to tick the box. And I was really heartened by that. They were very quick to tell me, though, that they do look over the students' choices like hawks to ensure that they are sensible choices. But ultimately, I thought that was really encouraging and really great for those that have learning needs or just different ways of looking at the curriculum. And as your point, right at the beginning, when we were talking about we are preparing students ultimately to go into the real world. If you are not naturally somebody that can remember loads of facts really well, that's particularly scientifically bent, then why do those subjects? Why don't you concentrate on things that are really going to inspire you? That was their main message. We want kids to be inspired and that may have some use in the future. And I like that very much. David, have you seen something similar or do you disagree with what I'm saying?
No, I thoroughly agree. I was actually going to sort of start to bring it together because I was thinking back to our original provocation for this conversation, which is what would a dream school look like? And are we saying, just to be clear, that all the aspects we've talked about from the sensory aspects and the environment and the memory and the curiosity and the plasticity, these all make up our dream school? Am I right in? I'm probably sort of pushing that point a little bit. Does that sound about right, Rebecca?
I think we need about 15 podcasts to go through every detail, but
15 more podcasts,
absolutely, definitely. If I can, I had a go just before we came online at distilling it down to, I got 5 points. I tried three, but I've made
Go
five.
for it.
Can I read them to you? So
Read
first
them
of all,
out.
I would start with what we want children to actually do in life. Okay, so we have to create work that feels real and matters and has relevance for them in their life beyond school. Second one, start with a human brain. So how does a brain actually learn, and design the learning around that, not around curriculum and timetabling issues and the batch processing. But let's take the brain learns like this. First of all, let's deeply know them. Let's understand their emotions. Let's understand that learning is their fourth priority, and then design the content around that. Third, make well-being foundational and not a bolt-on. So we're learning with joy. There's a school near here, and their tagline is "Achieve with joy," and I think it's brilliant. Because so often we have a lesson, and you think it's okay to be playful and it's okay to be joyous. Or when somebody from SLT comes to observe, suddenly you get this compulsion to not smile or joke or laugh and be terribly serious. So I think we can be playful, we can have joy, and we can have fun. I think we should rethink how we group, assess, and schedule. So too often we're sticking with a system because it's familiar, but why do we need hour-long lessons? Why not have two lessons a day, three lessons a day? That would be so magical, wouldn't it? And then everybody can go deep and run with the stuff that interests them. Why can't we have mixed age group? More and more schools are doing this now, and the research is coming back very positively. Human beings were designed to live in small groups and tribes in the Stone Age world. They weren't designed to be batched according to their date of manufacture. So let's have mixed age grouping. Let's have children picking which level they're at. So at one fantastic school I'm working with at the moment, they have three desks, and the children in the classroom are years 3, 4, 5, 6, and they choose which desk they go at for English and for maths and whatever. And the teacher says, "We don't care where they are at a given time. We just know where the end point is." They choose their own journey. They pick their journey. So these children never feel panicked. They always feel like they have agency, autonomy, and control, and that the learning is appropriate for them. Then I would definitely take inspiration from the very best schools. I would go and look in Finland, Japan, Singapore. I think we should, what they do that we don't do perhaps so well over here is they really invest in teacher expertise, and they trust teachers to have a lot more say, and the teaching profession itself is more respected than it is here. So there we go. I don't think we should copy each other, and the dream school wouldn't blindly adopt one model, but it would distill the very best ideas, but ask how can we adapt that to our local needs? What's right for this child in this place at this time? There we go.
That was a brilliant distillation. Thank you, Rebecca, and really clearly put. I noticed when you were talking, you mentioned going to visit schools in Japan, and that actually neatly brings me on to something that David read about, which was about a Japanese teacher. David, tell us more.
Yes. Well, what we'll do is we're going to put this essay, because it's an essay, onto the show notes so you can have a look at it. But effectively, it's an essay about a Japanese head teacher in Cornwall. And if that sounds implausible, all I'll say is just read the essay and see what you think. What was curious about it was that it was effectively around the idea of designing a dream school. And what this dream school in Cornwall looks like is quite similar in some ways to what Rebecca's laid out here. I think that shouldn't be surprising because, as I said at the beginning, there is a compulsion within us to want to provide the best. And going back to that Platonic ideal, if you like, the archetype, is the we all know what a perfect school looks like. As Rebecca, you said, schools will be different according to the context, according to the place. But I think it's pretty clear that all parents, all educators, all teachers have a vision of what a perfect school would look like. They may not have all the kind of details, the plumbing and the groundskeeping and all that kind of thing might be a little fuzzy, but I do think we all have that in some way. And these conversations are so brilliant because they allow us to share that and to maybe speak it into reality. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think what I like about the conversation we've had today about a dream school is, quite frankly, some of the things, particularly to do with timetabling and amazing project-based learning, is ultimately not a reality right now because it would require the whole kind of national curriculum changing, really, where teachers are sort of almost expected and required to get children to and the objective to hit. And that's a bigger conversation about actually ultimately the whole system needs changing. But what's great about today is that those sort of, I suppose, tips aside, there are loads of things in this podcast that teachers can run with straight away. Loads of those tips about the physical learning environment of a classroom, or actually just simply recognizing that when children are engaged in a project rather than little itty bitty bits of learning, that really engages them. So encouraging teachers to put more of those into their lesson plans throughout the year, and just think, you know what, actually, it's really important to do these things, and we could perhaps push out a couple of things that are less important to ensure that we're building some real life learning. So I feel like you've done such an amazing job, Rebecca, at giving us some fascinating theory and reminding us about how children learn and what suits them best, but just brilliant tips as to how we can all become better teachers in the classroom. So I really want to just say a huge thank you to you for coming on to chat to us. It's been absolutely invaluable. And David, not only has he taken off his black jumper now, he's also doing a little air clap to the side as well to show his
We call it a
appreciation.
marshmallow clap. I think in EYFS they call it a marshmallow clap, and it's quite a fun
Oh,
one. Yeah,
yeah,
you
I'm
can have a go
clapping a
at it.
marshmallow. I'm visualizing that. So, thank you so much. So, it just leaves me to say, goodbye, really, from us all, and thank you, Rebecca. You've been listening to Education Sense with me, Isabel Rich, and my co-host, David Marshall. Thank you.